Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger returns with a commentary on Parshat Vayigash. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member at Pardes and serves as the Pardes Mashgiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's Parsha is Parshat Vayigash. Last year, we examined the personality of Joseph. Today, I would like to examine the personality of Yehuda, and to understand why, ultimately, he is the father of royalty. Let us begin by looking at last week's parsha in chapter 42. And as background for our exploration, the brothers go down to Egypt during a time of famine in order to purchase food. They encounter Joseph, who is the second to Pharaoh, who is in charge of distributing all of the food resources. Joseph recognizes them, but they do not recognize him. Rather than Joseph revealing himself to them, Joseph acts and speaks harshly to them. Joseph accuses them of being spies. He tells them that in order to prove their innocence, he will hold one of the brothers hostage, Shimon, until the brothers go back and bring with them their youngest brother, Benjamin, in order to validate their claim that they are 12 brothers. When the brothers come back to Jacob, they discover which the money which they had brought down to purchase the food, which they had given to Joseph, was somehow returned in their sacks. They are terrified because they feel that they are being framed. And when they tell Jacob the only way to retrieve Shimon, the only way to go back and get more food, is for them to take Benjamin, Jacob's response in chapter 42, verse 36, Jacob says to them, "You have bereaved me. Joseph is not here. Shimon is not here. You will take Benjamin, and all of them will be upon me." All of them upon me, meaning the weight of the loss of all of them will devastate me. Or perhaps Jacob feels he will be accountable for the fact that three of his sons have disappeared, died, perhaps as a result of his wrongdoing in how he handled his family. And then we find in verse 37 that Reuven wants to convince his father and take on a leadership role to be able to somehow correct the situation. And Reuven says to his father in verse 37, "You can kill my two sons if I don't bring him back. Give him in my custody, and I will return him to you." When one hears Reuven's proposal, it sounds outrageous, ridiculous. How could Reuven even entertain the notion of killing my two sons? And in fact, this point is acknowledged in a midrash, which says that Jacob says to Reuven, "They're your sons and not my sons?" Clearly, Reuven did not intend for Jacob to kill his two sons. He simply uses this as an expression to indicate how sure he is that he will ultimately bring Benjamin back. But we read in verse 38 that Jacob's response is, "My son will not go down with you, for his brother has died. He alone has remained. If an accident, if a calamity shall occur to him on the way, you will bring down my old age in sorrow to the grave." One little point to note. In verse 38, it doesn't say, "And Jacob said to Reuven." It simply says, "And Jacob said." Reuven's proposal is so ridiculous that Jacob doesn't even address him. And then we are told in the continuation of the story, chapter 43, verse 1, "And the famine was very heavy in the land. And when they had finished eating the produce which they had brought down from Egypt, Jacob says to them, 'Return, buy us a little bit of food.'" This verse is very, very touching. We can sense a bit of desperation in Jacob's voice. There is no longer any food. Jacob says to them, "Go back, get a little bit of food." Perhaps with the implication, if all that you buy is a little bit, maybe they won't notice you. At which point we find Judah speaking up in verse 3. And Yehuda said, "But the man testified against us. Do not see me unless your brother is with you." There are two things to note over here, which say something very important about Judah as a leader. The first, timing. When do you speak? When do you act? Reuven spoke up immediately when the brothers came back. At that moment, Jacob and the brothers are overwhelmed with a sense of doom. Perhaps nothing which Reuven could have said at that point could have made a difference, could have made an impression. Judah waits. He waits for the famine to be heavy. He waits for the food to run out. He waits for Jacob to come to them and ask them to go back and get food. The moment that is Jacob who proposes going back, it gives an opening to a dialogue where perhaps Judah can then convince him that there is no other recourse. Point number one. Point number two. The first thing which Judah says to Jacob is, don't think that we can simply buy a little bit of food and in that way circumvent the man who is looking for your son. The man, Joseph, unequivocally said, "You cannot see me unless you bring your younger brother," which means Judah says, in no uncertain terms, there is no way that we can go back to Egypt without bringing Benjamin. And now we come to the next thing. In verse 4, "If you will send our brother with us, we will go down and buy to you food." Verse 5, "And if you do not send him down, we will not go down, because the man said to us, 'Do not see me without your brother.'" Judah now builds on his first point and expands it and makes it clear to Jacob, there are two options. One option is to send our brother with us, and then we will go and we will buy to you food. If you want food, this is how you're going to get it. Send our brother with us. But if you don't send him, there is absolutely no possibility of getting food, because the man said, "Do not see me without your brother." And then we begin to find the crack in Jacob's position. In verse 6, "And Israel said, 'Why have you done this evil to me, to tell the man that you had a brother?'" And it is very clear that he is beginning to break down. He may very well send the brother, but he is complaining, he's venting, that he has been placed in such a terrible position. And note the fact that in verse 7, it is not only Judah, but it is all the brothers who pick up Judah's lead and say to him, "The man asked us about our birthplace. He asked us, 'Is our father still alive?' He asked us, 'Do you have a brother?' We simply responded to his questions. It's not that we volunteered this information. Could we have ever imagined that he would then use that information against us to say, 'Bring down your brother'?" So that on the one hand, the brothers are responding to Jacob's pain. But then we get to verse 8, which is now Yehuda taking on his leadership role. "And Yehuda said to Israel, his father, 'Send the lad with me. Let us get up. Let us go. Let us live and not die. Also us, also you, also our young children.'" Whereas earlier, Yehuda said to Jacob, "You have two options. Decide which one you want to pick." Now Yehuda is not just simply leaving it to Jacob, but is in fact telling him the choice that has to be made. "Send the lad with us. Let us get up," meaning we have no time to lose. We need to be on the move. And we need to be on the move because we want to live and not die. And the last point which he makes to Jacob is, it's not just a question of us. It's not just a question of you. It's the little children. You, Jacob, are so concerned about what will happen to Benjamin. But by not doing anything, you will ultimately bring about the death of young babies. After having laid out what needs to be done, Yehuda continues in verse 9 and says, "I will guarantee him. From my hand you will seek him out. If I do not bring him back to you and present him before you, I will have sinned to you all the days." What you find expressed in this verse is personal accountability. It is my responsibility. I guarantee it. It is my commitment to you I will guarantee to bring him back, to present him before you, beyond any shadow of a doubt. I will see that you see him. I will see to it that you see him. And if I don't do it, I will have sinned to you all of my days. Yehuda does not invoke his sons. Yehuda says, it is my responsibility. And one might even hear in what Yehuda is saying, I will have to live with the guilt for the rest of my life, knowing the pain which I caused you, knowing the fact that in the end, I did not come through on my commitment to you. And then the final statement, verse 10. If it not had been that, had we not tarried, we could have returned already twice. Time is of the essence. There is a famine, a heavy famine. The longer we wait, it may be too late. So what do we find here, expressed by Yehuda, demonstrating his leadership? The first thing is knowing when to speak. Don't speak up immediately. Don't speak up at a time when your words cannot be heard. Wait for the opportune moment. Wait until the other side invites a dialogue, initiates the conversation. Second thing, speak in very clear terms. Make it very clear to the person you're speaking to what the options are. There's no room for fudging. Be upfront. And after you have made the options clear, if the people that you're speaking to somehow still refuse to acknowledge those possibilities, make it clear which option is the desirable one. Make it clear what price will be paid if that option is not taken. Our little children will die. Make it clear that it is critical to act immediately. There is no time to lose. And be ready to take personal responsibility for seeing through your mission. Do not place the responsibility on anyone else except upon you. Make it clear that this is a question of a personal commitment to the other side, which if breached, you will have to live with for the rest of your life. And so we find in verse 11, and subsequently in verse 12, that Jacob immediately responds to Judah's proposal. In effect, what Judah did was not only to get Jacob's agreement, but to actually empower Jacob. Because at that moment, he's not called Jacob, he's called Israel. As Israel, he then says to them, so this is the game plan. Bring down various gifts to this man as a way of buttering him up, which perhaps echoes what Jacob did when he was dealing with Esav, which from his perspective certainly succeeded. Return the money. Bring extra money. And the final thing, may God watch over you. In verse 14, may God watch over you that you bring back not only Benjamin, but your other brother. Your other brother certainly is a reference to Shimon, but perhaps is an allusion even to Joseph. What you see from this is a good leader not only knows when to act, how to act, to take responsibility, but ultimately also knows how to empower the people around him, so that somehow Jacob now comes alive, and in the end they follow his lead. As we know, when the brothers go back down, they have a very, very positive meeting with Joseph. But then at the very end, Joseph frames them. He has the man in charge of his house place a special cup in Benjamin's sack. And when the brothers leave, the man chases after them and says to them, how could you have possibly stolen the special cup of my master? And lo and behold, as they empty their sacks, they discover the cup in the sack of Benjamin. And one can imagine that the brothers are not thinking, how could Benjamin do this? But very much see this as some sort of plot to frame them. And I just want to look at one verse. This is chapter 44, verse 15. Joseph says to the brothers when they are brought back, what is this action that you have done? Don't you know that a man like me is able to divine and to be able to know who took my thing? And in verse 16, Yehuda's response is, what can we say to our master? What can we speak? How can we justify ourselves? God has found the sins of your servants. Behold, we are ready to be servants to our master, us and the one by whom you found your cup. And Joseph's response is, "Heaven forbid that I should do such a thing. The one by whom I found the cup, he shall be my servant. And you go up in peace to your father." When Judah says to Joseph, "What can we say? How can we justify ourselves?" On one level, what Judah is saying to Joseph is that I don't want to give you any excuses. But what he's saying is, it is ultimately God who is somehow punishing us for our sins. And we can perhaps hear in Judah's voice that he is now taking responsibility, accepting the penalty for having sold his brother into slavery, acknowledging that God now perhaps is doing to them measure for measure. They sold their brother to be a slave. Judah is now decreeing upon himself, "Let us be slaves to you. This is the price that we need to pay for what we did to our brother." There is much more to what he's saying than the man realizes. For our purposes, it is very important to note that in this comment, Judah is now seeing the hand of God in what is happening in the events around him. Judah sees that there's much more to the story than just a man who is trying to frame him and his brothers. But somehow God is orchestrating things. God is ultimately making them pay the price for the crime of selling their brother into slavery. He is declaring the verdict. We shall all be slaves to our master. And note that Joseph refuses to accept that. Joseph says, "Go back to your father. Only Benjamin shall be taken as a servant." And so we now come to the beginning of our parsha, a dramatic speech which Yehuda makes to Joseph, an impassioned speech where the bottom line is that he will not sell out his brother Benjamin. And perhaps for us, he will not sell out this brother the same way he sold out Joseph. So now let us look at the beginning of our parsha. "And Judah came near to him, and he said, 'Please, my master, let your servant please speak in the ears of my master. Do not be angry at your servant, because you are like Pharaoh.'" Rashi, in his comments, says that we find coming near as being an expression of petitioning. And clearly over here, when we look at this verse, Yehuda comes across as begging. A number of times he says, "I am the servant, you are the master. Please listen to me. Let my words enter your ears." Yehuda is looking for a dialogue. It is very striking when he says, "Do not be angry at your servant." At face value, do not be angry at your servant, because he is challenging what Joseph said in the last verse of last week's parsha. Joseph said unequivocally, "I will take Benjamin as my servant. You go home." And here's Judah, who now has the audacity to argue, to try to change that decision. "Therefore, do not be angry with me that I'm arguing with you. I am not challenging your authority. Ki chamocha kefaroh, because you are like Pharaoh." Let's look a little bit further. Judah then goes on to recount the history of the discussions between them. And in verse 19, he says, "Our master asked his servant, saying, 'Do you have a father or a brother?' And we said to our master, 'We have an elderly father. We have a child of his old age and a brother who died. And he alone was left to his mother and his father who loved him.'" I should perhaps read this more carefully. "He alone was left to his mother, comma, and his father loves him." Let me just go on a little bit more. "And you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me, that I may place my eye upon him.' And we said to our master, 'The lad cannot leave his father. If he will leave his father, he will die.'" And although it's ambiguous, it would seem to be that "he will die" is a reference to the father, who will die because he is heartbroken. "And you said to your servants, 'If your younger brother does not come down with you, do not see me again.'" Note in all the verses which I read, again and again, Judah comes back to the idea, "We are the servants, you are the master. We're not trying to challenge you. We are not trying to threaten you. He's recounting all these facts. Towards what end? The argument that can be made is that he's trying to play on Joseph's emotions to elicit his compassion. Perhaps there's also a certain claim, charge, under the surface which he's making to Joseph. What Judah's trying to show Joseph is that throughout their discussions, Judah and the brothers were upfront with Joseph. Whatever he asked them, they responded to. On the other side, Joseph perhaps was being unreasonable with the brothers. And so you find in Midrash Tanchuma, when Judah says, "And you asked us, do you have a brother, do you have a father?" Under the surface, Judah is attacking Joseph. Why is that relevant if we're coming to buy food? Did you ask anybody else who was buying food about their family history? So that although on the one hand, Judah seems to be begging Joseph, seems to be trying to somehow vindicate their position, under the surface, he's also attacking Joseph. And that may explain why in the earlier pasuk, Judah said, "Do not be angry at me." Because there's a veiled challenge. Look at how you acted to us and how we acted to you. We were up front. We acted in total honesty, answering all of your questions. You acted in a very devious way. You asked us questions which are irrelevant. After we told you that we had a father who is old, who has a son who he cherishes, a son who cannot leave his father, because that would be absolutely devastating to our father. You were harsh. You were cruel. You insisted, "Do not see me unless you bring your brother." Why? Why were you so cruel to us? And then Judah goes on in verse 24, "And when we came to our father, your servant," not only are we your servants, our father is your servant, "and we told him all your words. And our father said, 'Go back, buy a little bit of food.'" Once again, he tries to evoke the pathetic situation, the desperate situation that Jacob is in, where Jacob is saying, "So buy a little bit. Maybe he can just ignore everything else." "But we told him, 'We can't do that. We cannot see the man without bringing our younger brother.'" And then in verse 27 and 28, Judah puts words in his father's mouth. "You know that my wife bore me two children." Jacob did not say that. And Jacob wouldn't say that. Because Jacob did not have just one wife. He had four wives. Jacob would not be so obnoxious to his sons. But nevertheless, Judah says it as a way of highlighting. Jacob did have a favorite wife. And they all know it. And she had two children, and one of them is no longer there. And therefore, if all of a sudden Jacob now gives up this other son, and something happens, they will bring down his old age in evil to the grave. And then Judah leads up this dramatic speech with verse 10, where he says, "And now if I come to my father, your servant, and the lad is not with us, and his life is bound up with his life," and note the fact that this is a verse, but it's like a dangling statement, because it's building up to the climax, which is in verse 31. "When he will see that the lad is not there, he will die. And your servants will have brought down the old age of our father, your servant, in sorrow to the grave." Judah is trying to get the message across to Joseph. You are going to kill our father if you take Benjamin to be your servant. We cannot do that to our father. We cannot see our father die, go down in sorrow to the grave. And then in verse 32 and 33, "Your servant guaranteed the lad from my father. If I don't bring him back to you, I will have sinned to you all of my days." Judah explains why he is the spokesman. He has a vested interest. He has personally guaranteed the safety of Benjamin. And then in verses 33 and 34, Judah proposes, "Let me be the servant instead of the lad. Let the lad go back. I will be the servant. I cannot go back to my father, and the lad is not with me, lest I see the evil that will find my father." So let us summarize what we have in this section. Here is Judah, who makes a dramatic speech to Joseph, who not only recounts the facts, but does it in a way which is trying to highlight the innocence of the brothers. How the brothers, from beginning to end, recognized Joseph as the master. They are the servants. The brothers were upfront in everything which they had to say to Joseph. Joseph, on the other hand, was unreasonable, was harsh, was cruel. He asks them questions which are totally irrelevant. He makes demands which are unacceptable. He is basically bringing their old father to his grave in sorrow. And the message which Judah is saying to Joseph is that your demand is unreasonable. Not only is it unreasonable, but unacceptable. I cannot live with that. I cannot accept that. I cannot accept it because I cannot bring that to my father. I cannot accept it because I personally guaranteed the safety of the lad. I am offering you a counterproposal. Take me instead of the lad. That's reasonable. More than reasonable. If Joseph wants a servant, here he has Judah, who can certainly be a much better servant than Benjamin. Judah, who he knows, is much stronger, much more capable. What Judah does now with Joseph is the ultimate demonstration of his leadership. He tries to present a case, which is absolutely convincing, as to why Joseph should accept his proposal, why Joseph should take Judah instead of Benjamin. Judah not only promised his father, Benjamin, but he is now doing everything to make that into a reality. He will not budge from that spot until Joseph accepts his demand. He makes it clear to Joseph that this is not just a request, it's a demand. It's a demand which is based on justice. It's a demand which is based on compassion. Joseph should have compassion on his old father, on their old father. Joseph should realize the delicacy of the situation. Joseph cannot be so uncompromising. And hence we find in chapter 45, verse 1, and Joseph can no longer restrain himself to all that are present. And as we read in the continuation, Joseph then reveals himself to the brothers. I would just like to point out that there are a number of commentaries who are troubled by why Joseph went through this whole charade. Why couldn't Joseph reveal himself immediately to the brothers and save so much heartache, so much aggravation, so much pain? And perhaps the answer which I would like to suggest is that Joseph does not want to reveal himself to the brothers until he is able to see who the brothers really are, to see that they are now ready to really accept him. When Joseph sees that Judah, the one who is instrumental in having Joseph sold as a slave, is now prepared to do everything to prevent Joseph's brother Benjamin from being quote-unquote sold as a slave. When Joseph hears that Judah says, God has found the sin of your brothers, the sin of your servants, excuse me, and we will all be slaves, all be servants, Joseph sees that the brothers have undergone a real transformation. Joseph is overwhelmed by the words of Judah. As I mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, Judah demonstrates the qualities that it takes to be a leader. We live in an age where we somehow feel that we have a lack of leadership. And that's why these parshiyot are so important, because maybe they crystallize to us what it takes to be a leader. And so let me now just wrap up and say the following. A leader has to be somebody who has a very keen sense of timing, who even when they know what their mission is, are not impulsive, but know how to have patience, to find the right moment to act. On the one hand, Judah waits when his father will be receptive to hearing his words. On the other hand, once he sees that Jacob is now at a point where he's ripe to listen, he says, let us not tarry anymore. We have no time to lose. You can't be impulsive, but you also have to know that once the opportunities present themselves, to act immediately and decisively. You have to know how to speak to the people around you, when to be conciliatory, when to challenge. You have to also be able to speak in such a way which shows that you're authentic, not to speak in ambiguities, but to speak in very, very clear language, so that the message is gotten across, that you have a very clear goal and you will not waver from that goal. On the one hand, Judah makes it very clear to his father, We must go back to Egypt. We must take Benjamin with us. Judah makes it very clear to Joseph, I cannot allow Benjamin to be your slave, to be your servant. It is not enough to just speak clearly and to make it clear what your goals are, but you have to be able to take responsibility, to put your money where your mouth is, to realize that if you don't come through on what you say, you will have sinned for all of your days. You will be responsible and have to bear the guilt of your crime. As Judah says, God has found the sin of your servants. It is very clear that Judah had the sale of Joseph on his mind and is bearing the guilt for that sale. And perhaps the last thing which I would like to say, which comes across in the story, is that a true leader is able to learn from their mistakes, to change, and to not repeat the errors of the past. Judah sold Joseph as a slave. He is now put in a position where he can also sell out Benjamin to be a slave. Judah realizes the mistake of selling Joseph. Judah realizes the pain that it caused his father. He's not prepared to then reinforce that by selling Benjamin, to make the same mistake again. And even if it means that he will now have to be a slave for the end of his days, let that be. But let him not make the same mistake of the past. Let him now take a stand and bear the consequences of his action. And ultimately, Judah triumphs. Ultimately, it's that stand which brings about the reconciliation between Joseph and his brothers, which brings about the restoration of the family. Judah is the one who has the capability of uniting the family. Later on, his descendant, King David, is the one who unites the Jewish people by making Jerusalem as his capital. As I say this podcast, Israel is in the midst of an operation to basically enable the residents of the southern part of Israel to live in peace, to live normal lives. I would just like to say that the government that we have is demonstrating leadership, leadership which perhaps should have been expressed months, years ago, but better late than never. It is very important for us to be able to realize that the residents of the south of Israel are part of Israel, that we have Anochi Ervenu, we have a sense of mutual responsibility one to the other. How can I live going about my normal life in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or other parts of the country when my brothers in the south are captive, captive to people who want to kill them? May this operation bring about a change in our reality, may in fact be a corrective for other mistakes that have been made in the past, and may this bring about a greater sense of unity among the Jewish people, with an ability to go about leading our lives normally, in peace, with the people around us. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.